Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 228th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a bi-weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. I've been looking forward to making this episode. It's a special one. Currently, I'm attending a semester-long certificate program at Maine College of Art called the SALT Institute for Documentary Studies. When I first started there in January, I invited my classmates to come participate in New Mainers Speak if they wished. And today, it's happening. My classmate Alexa Burke will be interviewing our classmate Neroli Price, who's from Cape Town, South Africa. Originally, we were all three going to be hanging out in the studio together, but as COVID would have it, this was a digital collaboration that required taping phone calls on two ends, beaming files digitally, mixing in my home studio, and finally sending it on to the station for our heroic staffers to play for you. Truly, it's a modern feat compared to our usual live broadcasts. A very special thank you goes out to everyone involved in this process today. Please enjoy Alexa Burke's visit with SALT classmate Neroli Price.
Hi, Neroli. I am so excited to talk with you today. Let's just jump right in.
Sounds good.
So you grew up in Cape Town. Can you take us on a little tour of Cape Town? Are there some like sounds or smells or things that you just really love?
So many. Cape Town is, I think, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that, even though I am probably really very biased. It is my hometown. It has a mountain in the middle of the city. It's called Table Mountain, and it's a national park. So I don't think there are that many cities that have a national park in the middle of them. It's also surrounded on both sides by ocean. So there's the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean. So basically anywhere you are in the city, you always have mountain or sea. In terms of smells or sounds, Cape Town has a very diverse population of people. South Africa was colonized by the Dutch and the English at various points in history. And there were indigenous populations and people moving from different parts of the world. There were also a lot of slaves brought to Cape Town. And so there's a big what is called Cape Malay population, who are predominantly Muslim. And so the sound that I always think of, well, there's a few sounds. The one that I think of is call to prayer, the mosque call to prayer. And the other one is the noonday gun. There's this tradition in Cape Town. I don't even know how long it's been going on for, but I would say probably hundreds of years, where there's a cannon in the middle of the city that is shot every day at noon to mark noon. And if you don't know about the sound and you're in the city, it's quite scary. But for people who've lived there for a long time, it's kind of this comforting sound that marks the middle of the day. In terms of smells, it really depends where you are. Like I said, if you're by the sea is just such a nice smell. On the mountain, you really smell what's called fynbos. It's like indigenous vegetation. And especially after it's rained, it has a very particular smell. It's very earthy, very floral. And that's just, I really, really miss that smell in particular when you walk on the mountain after a rain. But Cape Town is often, I think, quite aptly described as both a really beautiful and a really ugly city in some ways, because it's still very much struggling with the legacy of apartheid era geography or structural planning. So the city is very racially divided, and South Africa is one of the most unequal countries in the world. And so you really see that in the way Cape Town is laid out as a city. And I think that's a real, really it's a really tough part of our history that we still live with in a very concrete way, and it's not the way it should be 26 years after apartheid ended. But if you visit the city, you will very much see those divides very apparently in the layout.
Is that based on like different neighborhoods, or is it like different proximity to the like Table Mountain, or what does that mm-hmm. look like?
So Table Mountain's kind of in the middle of the city, and at the bottom of Table Mountain towards the sea is what's called the City Bowl, which is like the downtown of Cape Town, and that's kind of the center of the economic activity. And so everything spreads out from there around the sides of the mountain. And there you have all the rich white suburbs. You have your Bishop's Court. You have your Camps Bay. You have your Newlands. You have Hout Bay. So it's a bunch of predominantly white affluent suburbs all around the mountain. And the further out you go, the more you get into black neighborhoods, Khayelitsha, Mitchell's Plain, and those areas were very much strategically designed by the apartheid government to remove black people from the city center. So it was very much it's social engineering, it's racist laws that are justifying separating people into different spaces, but also you're excluding certain people from the hub of activity in a very calculating, really abhorrent racist way.
Hmm. Something I wanted to I want to get back to that mm-hmm. but something I wanted to ask you about is your mm-hmm. name. Mm-hmm. I feel like you're like everyone's name is very special, but yours is mm-hmm. particularly unique. Can you tell us your full name?
Sure. My name is Neroli Nomvuyo Morgan Price. And so Neroli, often people ask me, like, is that a South African name? Where does it come from? It's not a South African name. It's just a smell my mom liked when she was pregnant. It's an essential oil. So you find it in like soaps and perfumes and shampoos and stuff. So she just really liked that. It's like lavender or tea tree or something. She actually wanted to name my brother Bergamot, but I think my dad vetoed that one. And so his name is Thomas, which is a much more simpler name in a lot of ways. But Nomvuyo is a Xhosa name. Xhosa is one of South Africa's 11 official languages. And it means joy in Xhosa. And so, this links to a South African tradition where during apartheid, a lot of Xhosa speakers or Zulu speakers, Sotho speakers, any non-English speakers were forced to really have a white sounding or English name so their employers could pronounce their names. So people would have names like Elizabeth or John or whatever, kind of standard English names. Mm-hmm. And this was seen as like, you know, part of the oppression. It's kind of having to fit yourself into someone else's mold, especially in South Africa, where white people are the numerical minority. It's really kind of stark. And so my parents were very active in the anti-apartheid struggle and were very excited when I was born in 1990, which was the year that Mandela was released, that South Africa would change. We'd have democracy and maybe in the future, white people with English names would have to have Xhosa names or Zulu names or Tswana names. And so I think as kind of tipping their hat to that transformation, they gave me a Xhosa middle name, kind of embracing this new rainbow nation that we were going to embark on. Morgan is a weird one. It's Mawrgan, and that's a Welsh name, a weird Welsh name, because my grandmother is Welsh. So it was kind of to honor that legacy.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really neat how in your name you have all these different, like, your parents are very intentional about about like sort of their hopes for the future of South Africa, like in your name.
And another thing that's kind of funny, I mean, Price is not that unusual at all really, but my brother and I have different surnames because my parents were never married, and so I took my mom's surname and my brother took my dad's. So yeah, it's also interesting. I don't think it's that common to have your mom's surname either. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. You mentioned something, the Rainbow Nation. Can you, what is that?
Well, it's a euphemism, really, at this point in time. But it was to mark the hope for a future South Africa, where I talked about the city and the divisions earlier and how they're very stark. So there was this very active project, to divide South Africans and to literally physically remove them and put them into different spaces and to give certain South Africans certain rights and others not, based on your race. And so when apartheid ended, and we had our first democratic elections in 1994, there was this hope for a country that was more coming together and more mixed. And so the rainbow is about acknowledging all the different colors in the rainbow, that we're all so different, but that we come together. So it was a very hopeful way of talking about the new democratic South African future.
And you say that it's a euphemism. Did that not come to happen, or is that more like idealized than what happened after 94?
I think it's very accurate for the time, because at the time, I think it's really hard to like understand now what a big deal it was at the time that apartheid ended. I think a lot of people thought it's never going to end. The state is way too powerful. It has way too many allies in the West, because it styled itself as this anti-communist force. And I think when it eventually ended, and a big part of that was the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the end of the communist threat globally, or perceived threat, I think it was, people didn't expect that apartheid could ever end. And so when it did, it was this incredible miracle. The language you hear of that era is miracle, rainbow nation, born frees. So like people like me who are born after apartheid or grew up after apartheid are called born frees. And there's this hope that's conferred on the next generation that they will have opportunities and live in a different South Africa that their parents ever had. So there was a lot of optimism and hope for this, building this new nation that activists had been dreaming about for generations, and that their parents hadn't realized. You know, in 1994 was the first time all South Africans could vote. So before that, it was only white South Africans. So you have like old people who for the first time can vote in the country of their birth. It's a huge moment. People were lining down blocks. There's famous photos of people just lining up, wrapping around blocks. There was such a huge voter participation because it was the first time people were able to vote in their own country. And so there was such a hopefulness. And I think now looking back, it kind of seems quaint or outdated. And I think, you know, we have a lot more perspective now. But I think it's also important to remember that that was real at that time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
If you are just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. The guest host is Alexa Burke. She's interviewing Neroli Price of Cape Town, South Africa. Both women are presently attending the SALT Institute for Documentary Studies, based in Portland, Maine. Though only one is currently in Portland. They visit by phone in this pre-recorded interview during the days of COVID.
So you moved to Seattle, was it in 2018?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Do you think or feel differently about South Africa since being away for 2 years? Has that changed a lot?
Yeah, I definitely feel differently. I think, I don't know if you have this experience where you miss someone or you miss a place and you kind of romanticize it in your mind. Like you emphasize all the good parts of it. And I think that definitely is how I feel. I feel really homesick. It's kind of like when you move out of your parents' home and you go to college and then you kind of miss it. And then you go back and you're so excited, and then you get there and for the first 5 minutes, it's great. And then after that, you're like, oh, this person irritates me. I don't have my own space. Like, you know, this person still has their old habits and I still react in this way. And there's all these old patterns, you know. So that's kind of how my relationship has been, I think. I really, really, really miss it a lot. And I go through patches where I'm really deeply homesick. But I think because of that, I tend to romanticize it a lot, which I think also is not the truth of the matter. Mm. It's just like I was describing to you Cape Town earlier. It's so much easier for me to conjure the good things than it is to conjure the bad things, even though there are plenty of bad things. South Africa is an incredibly divided and difficult place with a lot of problems. And I think a lot of people focus on that. And I think sometimes my attitude comes from when I meet other people who have very negative views of South Africa, I feel this duty to kind of bring a counterbalance. But I don't think either is true, realistically. Mm. Neither one is true. It's not terrible. It's not amazing. There's something in the middle. It's kind of like every place. But I tend to romanticize it. And I just miss it dearly. I miss my people, you know, like, I think the amazing thing about going to live in a different place for a while is that you realize all these things you have at home that you can't see when you're there. And I think that's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because there's all these kind of built-in little jokes, like sense of humor and cultural references and just slang and kind of understandings that you don't realize you'll miss. And then you go somewhere else and every conversation you have to explain 10 things before you can even get to the substance. And that's not anyone's fault. It's just the way it is. You can't expect that everyone knows something about where you come from. But I feel that very acutely here in the States. There's very little sense of South Africa or its history. And you know, that's not to be judgmental. It's just I miss the ease with which you can have those conversations and just be understood in a particular way at home, even though I kind of enjoy the freedom as well of not being pegged here, because no one can really tell that much about me from the way I speak.
You kind of have like a blank slate, which in some, I can imagine, sometimes is nice, but then other times you're like, wait, I just want people to know.
Yeah, all these exactly things. I want it all, and you can't have it all, right? Like, you can't. The States offers some things that home can't, and home offers other things that the States can't.
I'm curious, kind of as coronavirus has been spreading, and I feel like in a way we feel a lot more like connected globally, but also it's like such a strange time where we're in lockdown, like. How has that been, being away from your family and from South Africa in this time?
It's so weird. I mean, I think it's a weird time in general. It's very scary. It's very surreal. I feel like every day things just change and we have to kind of adjust to a new world. But I think there's an added layer to that. When your family lives halfway across the world and is experiencing this in a very different way, I think the thing that I keep coming back to is I described to you earlier, like the end of apartheid being this momentous time. And there's something about going through big, like, national events that bonds people, because you all can say, remember on that day, where were you? How did you hear about this thing? How did it make you feel? And there's kind of the shared reference of making it through something or experiencing something collectively. Mm. And I worry a lot about, I'm kind of, the longer I'm away, the more I miss out on those experiences. And this one feels like a big experience that people are experiencing individually, but also within a national context. And I'm just simply because of geography, I am experiencing it in a very different way to my friends and family. And so I feel like there's this big chunk of experience that's very fundamental and very global that I will have experienced in a very different way to them. I think we're all grieving for the loss of the lives we had, but I'm kind of future grieving of the missed shared experience that I will be missing out on, that we can't talk about that in the same way with the same language. You know, it'll always be, oh yeah, but you were in the States and so it was different for you. And that'll be true, you know, and it's just so weird. I think it's very stark right now how much geography is shaping our experience of this pandemic. I don't know if you want me to talk a little bit about South Africa and what's happening there.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, how the U.S. and South African responses have been different. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure you've had, like, a pulse very much on both of them. What has that been like?
Yeah, it's like you say, I mean, it's overwhelming just following one country, like following two. It's a bit much. So I try and, like, once a day check the numbers of the cases and deaths so that I don't spend too much time kind of obsessing about it. Mm-hmm. But we have family meetings every week just to check in with everyone, especially the older folks in the family. But so South Africa has had way fewer cases than the States. I think today they've had 1,000, as of today, had about 1,300 cases and 7 deaths. So much smaller scale than the US. But the response has been very different because South Africa is, in some ways, in the future of or is further down the isn't as far down the track as the US, rather. So it's the coronavirus has been in the States for longer, so we're seeing the consequences, whereas they haven't reached the same effect in South Africa yet. So what happened was that I think South Africa looked to the US and to China and to Italy and just saw this disaster and said, okay, no, we're not going down the same path. And so they enacted very proactive, very early measures that I think to a lot of people seem very harsh, but I think knowing what we know now is actually the right approach. So they shut down things really early. They're on a 3-week lockdown, and the lockdown is not, you can't even go outside to walk. You can't leave your house at all. And that's being enforced by the army and the police.
Wow.
And so it's incredibly strict. And I think part of that strictness comes from the fact that South Africa has a huge population of people with HIV and AIDS and TB, which are immune deficient conditions. And so they're very vulnerable to coronavirus. So I think there is an understanding and a seriousness with which the government is taking this. And our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has been incredible in his leadership in just being sympathetic, but also very straightforward and clear about the fact that this is a serious disease and we can't mess around with it. I think the worrying sign for me is that the use of the army to enforce these things is appropriate in an emergency. But it should never be appropriate in a democracy that the government has that much power in any democracy. So I think a lot of people are wary about the overreach of the state. And I think given the history I just told you about a few moments ago, South Africans are very aware of what it can be like when the state power overreaches and when freedoms are taken away, because for the majority of South Africans, that is in their living memory. And so people really guard those freedoms very closely. And so I think this kind of overreach always is going to set off some alarm bells. But then again, it's I think South Africa knows that this could be devastating, given as well the inequalities I spoke to you about earlier, that there are a lot of, it's such an unequal country that some people will be fine. Like, mostly white rich people will probably be fine, but the majority of South Africans are don't have the luxury of, like, having a ton of space or access to private hospitals, or, you know, we've got public healthcare, but it's struggling and it doesn't have the capacity to deal with a huge coronavirus outbreak. And so I think, like in every country, the structural inequalities and the vulnerabilities that exist are really being highlighted by this disease. And that's definitely the case in South Africa too.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of those, like, two, like, needing to hold these two things together. Like, it's so, like, important that their response be, you know, really strict like this. And it sounds like they're doing such a good job of that. But then also it's like, but it's because of the virus, like, that totally ends once it's not a risk anymore. But
And also, like this country, the economy is struggling, and the economy was struggling before, and that's devastating on a whole other level, you know, for people. So, but it's such a balancing act, because honestly, I personally am very glad that my grandmother is in South Africa and not in the US, because I've been pretty saddened by how the American president, Donald Trump, has been handling this. It's really, for such a well-resourced country, there is no reason why this needs to be as devastating as it potentially is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad to see, because it's people's lives, you know, and it's never okay to not prioritize people's lives, especially if you're the leader of a country.
Yeah. How's your gran doing?
she's good. She's amazing, actually. She's learning how to use Zoom and Google Hangouts and all these things so that we can chat every week. She's in an old age complex, which I'm a bit nervous about, because those seem to be the places where, if coronavirus gets in, can be really devastating. But she's got a good attitude. She does a lot of puzzles online. She loves sports. Yeah, she does puzzles online, like trivia online, and like coloring in online, and all these kind of games. She likes those a lot.
She sounds like such a modern grandma.
Oh yeah, she's very tech savvy. But she misses her sport a lot. That's something that I know she really misses. But she's okay. I mean, I think this is really hard for old people. She said the other day to me, "This makes me feel like I'm gonna die," you know. And she said, "I'm not ready for that." And she's 83, but she's incredibly, or 84 rather, but she's incredibly like fit and healthy and drives around. And so I think it's been a hard road for her to kind of deal with that, with that messaging of being so vulnerable.
Well, thank you so much for talking. I'm curious about the song that we're about to hear that you chose. Could you tell me about
it? Yeah, of course. So it's a song called Say Africa by a South African musician called Vusi Mahlasela. At home, I would never choose this song because it's incredibly cheesy. But here, with my nostalgic rose-tinted glasses, I love it so much. And what I love about it is Vusi is such a gentle singer and person and presence. He's very calming and sings these incredibly beautiful songs. But he sings about struggle, and he sings about difficulty, but also hope and reconciliation. And he was a voice of the anti-apartheid movement. And as I mentioned, my parents were very involved in that. And so it's a big, important part of my own upbringing, hearing those songs, because they're from kind of a lot of the songs that I love are from like the 80s or the struggle years. And so they're nostalgic to me because I heard them growing up. But Vusi performed at Mandela's inauguration. And Say Africa is this song about being in exile. And so a lot of South Africans went into exile, including my parents, during the struggle, because they couldn't be at home. And so I'm not in exile, but I'm far away from home. And so it resonates with me in terms of this feeling of missing home and knowing inside yourself that you're from there, but on the outside, people have no idea that you're missing home and you're in a foreign place. And so he speaks about that longing. And what I love about this song is that in a short song, he brings in history, complicated world history and politics, and he does it in a lyrical, beautiful way that you're being educated and you don't even realize it. And I think that's such a skill and such a joy. Exactly. So it's kind of cheesy and cute, but it's also like incredibly political and historical. And I just think that's so masterful that he was able to do that.
I'm excited to hear it.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Well, thanks. I hope
you enjoy it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Neroli. This has been really fun.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Stay safe and wash your hands, and
I will. You too.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you to Alexa Burke and Neroli Price from SALT for pre-recording this interview for New Manners Speak. If you would like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmannersspeak.com.
We cross Zimbabwe's border, flew over the dry fields of my homeland, coming into Joburg. The suntan swimming pools and sewing two shirts, airports and railway stations, stranded with a rucksack and guitar. The languages and the places change, and the sky has different stars. I may be walking in the streets of a city called London, but the dust on my boots and the rhythm of my feet and my heartbeat say Africa. I may be walking in the streets of a city called Amsterdam, but the dust on my boots and the rhythm of my feet and my heartbeat say Africa. 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 Say Africa.
Stones and the UN law and passport controls for countries that don't exist. It's a big world, they have their own problems everywhere, and there's gold in that clenched fist. People ask me where I'm from. I say Mandelodi Township, in a city called Tswane, meaning we are the same. I have a friend who's a great musician and is from Ebayi, near King Williamstown, you know where Steve Biko was born. You might have heard or seen a film about Africa. You know it's a big continent with the great gift of Ubuntu. I may be walking in the streets of a city called London, but the dust on my boots and the rhythm of my feet and my heart. Say Africa. I may be walking in the streets of a city called Amsterdam, but the dust on my boots and the rhythm of my feet and my heartbeat say Africa. Say Africa. Say Africa. Africa. Say Africa.